This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
All right, folks, we're back. We're back. Hour number two, live broadcast, live and direct here on TNT, Today's News Talk. Great to have you with us, and some big stories, important stories that we're covering today on the program. I want to throw this one out, too, while we wait for our political editor at TNT, Mr. Basil Valentine, is going to join us on the hoof in a few minutes. But this is interesting. Israel is raiding Associated Press's offices here, their facilities. That's interesting, isn't it? Why? Let's find out. They've raided AP's position, where they're basically doing a live stream in the southern part of Israel on Tuesday, claiming the agency was violating a new media law. Well, this is interesting. So Israel has passed a type of a Zelensky law, which is highly democratic, of course. And apparently AP's in violation because they're allowing the live broadcast to be retransmitted by their client, Al Jazeera. So Associated Press, Reuters, these are news agencies. These are news agencies. They work all around the world. Other outlets buy their feeds, buy their content, syndicate. Reuters, NAP, UPI, AFP, Agence French Press Agency as well. These are the main sort of, you know, some of the big ones. I don't know if UPI is really that much of a factor anymore. But anyway, Israel's all bent out of shape because Al Jazeera is rebroadcasting the live feed. They don't care if ABC does it. They don't care if even RT does it. But because Al Jazeera did it, they raided the AP offices. This is how insane and thuggish that the Israelis are. They can't handle it. If they had it their way, there'd be no press at all. They'd be handling all the press for this massacre that they're prosecuting in Gaza. I mean, I'm going to say shameful, but we're in this sort of shameless zone right now when it comes to all things Israel. Anyway, moving on swiftly, AP claims that Israeli communications ministry officials arrived at their live location. This probably have a camera set up somewhere on a hilltop somewhere in the south, standard fare, and basically two kilometers from Gaza in the southern Israeli settlement of Sidurat. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly. And this is near the scene of the Palestinian incursion on October 7th. And so they handed AP staff engineers a document signed by the communications minister, Shlomo Kari, alleging that the news agency, the world-famous news agency, was somehow in violation of the country's new controversial foreign broadcaster law, little Zelensky law, they've passed in Israel. And so they axed the live feed. Not only that, they confiscated the equipment and under national security threat. So even the Israeli media are subscribing to this live feed. It's just a camera of basically a landscape, a position showing there. It's reporters will come and do stand-ups in front of it, that type of thing. So it's just a standard live feed. And so apparently this is somehow a threat to their national security because Al Jazeera subscribed to that live feed. Isn't that stupid? Isn't that ridiculous? But yet this is what we have when it comes to the state of Israel. The state of Israel, the state of it, the state of the Israelis at the moment is something to behold. Anyway, that's the latest there. Amazing. So they're upset because AP is doing what AP has always done, which is provide news for syndication. Hey, call us crazy, but that's just insane. Anyway, over to Robert Fietz. I want to cover this because this is important. Interesting op-ed at RT.com from Timothy Bordachev. He is the program director at the Valdai Expert Club in Russia, foreign policy type of a think tank. They call them expert groups or expert clubs. Slovak MP's shooting shows us why Eastern Europe is doomed. What is he talking about? It's kind of an important perspective here. And I want to share this with you. If we bring Basil on the stream, we'll come back to this story. But if disagreement with the political choices leads to an assassination attempt of a prime minister, this means that sustainable democracy has not been built. So he's basically saying this assassination attempt shows that this is a complete collapse of the democratic system, really of the EU. And we're talking about the accession of the Eastern countries to the EU that are currently being used as cannon fodder in a proxy war between the US-led and British-led NATO and Russia. And they're using Ukraine, but not just Ukraine. They're using Poland, Slovakia, Romania, Hungary as basically the countries bordering Ukraine as cannon fodder, as a doormat for NATO, basically. And what the argument he's making here is this brutal assassination attempt of Robert Fico, the prime minister of Slovakia. This basically shows that Eastern Europe is doomed. They do not have a working democratic system. And if you think about it, the cult-like atmosphere that has been charged around this whole Ukrainian issue and Zelensky has radicalized people to the point where they're going out and basically trying to kill political leaders that aren't on board with the war. That's dangerous. But this cult-like atmosphere driven by the media and the political classes in Europe and the West, that is dangerous in itself. And this is the result of it. You cannot have an independent foreign policy. You cannot have a mandate in this type of an atmosphere. And it's a great op-ed here. And it harkens back to the events that led up to the First World War in Sarajevo with the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, etc. Interesting historical analysis, bringing us up to the present day. And this shows you a lot of things. And one of them is the EU and NATO are an abject failure at this point. They've taken this too far, and now it's really going to cause Europe itself to come apart at the seams. So a major own goal for the bureaucrats and the grifters in Brussels, and of course Washington couldn't care less. They're quite happy to throw Europe into a war with Russia because they'll be there with their big brooms and their dollars to clean up the mess afterwards. And loans for everybody. Let's reconstruct this mess. Don't worry, we'll save you. We've got loans. We've got a Marshall Plan. Don't you worry, Europe. We're your good friends. We'll occupy you militarily after everything gets cleaned up. We'll own you, and you'll be able to maybe make some goods for us for the American market. But you're sort of done at this point. That's the future of Europe, folks. Sorry to black pill you there, but it's pretty dark times. Anyway, what we're going to do right now, we're going to take a quick break. And on the other side, we're going to connect with TNT's political editor, Basil Valentine, who's going to be joining us on the live link. I'm Patrick Henningsen. Stay with us, folks.
In a democracy, the majority vote rules. But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
Don't touch that dial. Hey, don't touch that dial.
People need to wake up.
Today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back, folks. Welcome back. We're now on number 2, this live broadcast. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. This is TNT, Today's News Talk. Listen, we're going to shift gears right now for a world update. What are the hot topics? What are the hot stories? What do we need to know? There's no better person to bring on the call right now than TNT's political editor, Mr. Basil Valentine, is joining us right now on the live link. Basil, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Patrick. Great to be with you, and hello to our viewers and listeners all around the world.
Has it not been an eventful weekend? I mean, we came into Monday with an avalanche of major stories. The Iranian story, obviously, that's huge. The ICC arrest warrants, finally, against the Israeli leadership. That's pretty big. And also the Julian Assange appeal, a bit of good news for a change. So we've had a big start to the week, Basil. The ICC Israeli case, though, this thing looks like it's got legs. It certainly evoked a reflexive reaction from U.S. political leaders. They're not very happy about this. Netanyahu is kicking and screaming. I think we've got a clip of him. If we do have that clip, let's roll that. I want to get your reaction to this one, Basil.
He's creating a false symmetry between the democratically elected leaders of Israel and the terrorist chieftains. That's like saying in after 9/11, well, I'm issuing arrest warrants for George Bush, but also for bin Laden. Or after in World War II, well, I'm issuing arrest warrants for FDR, but also for Hitler. It's a hit job. It's not serious. He's out to defame Israel, and he's also pouring gasoline on the fires of anti-Semitism that are spreading around the world because he is attacking the one and only Jewish state and trying to handcuff us, preventing us from exercising responsibly through the laws of war as we obey them and we are subordinate to them. He's saying we're not. He's creating false symmetry, false facts, and he's doing a grave injustice to the international court.
I mean, like, there's a lot to unpack there, but did he just say the quiet part out loud about indicting George Bush for 9/11? I mean, that was something there. That would be a trick, wouldn't it?
The comparison was completely and utterly ludicrous. He also said at the top, democratically elected. Well, just because you're democratically elected, that doesn't mean you can't commit genocide, you know. So what if you were elected? You were only elected by the Israeli population. The Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza are deprived of a vote for the people that effectively control their lives. So, I mean, it was just almost laughable, but the chutzpah of the man is absolutely off the charts. Ironically, of course, Gazans are saying quite the opposite. They also see a false equivalence in the ICC charges, but from the other side. Did Hamas use planes to bomb Tel Aviv? Did they kill 35,000 people and still thousands more are missing? This is insane. The world is unjust. They see with one eye. How come they equate between us and the occupation? Said Samed, a mother of six, displaced by the war between different neighborhoods of Gaza City. And she's absolutely right. The scale of violence and suffering unleashed by the Israelis is many, many, many times over whatever happened on October the 7th, which, of course, the Israelis like to portray as somehow being the start of history, but was itself a reaction to decades of apartheid, regular mowing the lawn. What an obscene phrase to use for bombing innocent civilians. It's starting to unravel, though, for Netanyahu. I mean, he does still have the lockstep support of the senile Biden and the supine Rishi Sunak and David Cameron. I mean, I'd like to know what the Israelis have got on the likes of Sunak and Cameron, Biden, for that matter, that they keep on spouting this utterly immoral, indefensible, unethical garbage. Because, quite simply, they too may be complicit. A very good article in Declassified today by Mark Curtis, quite rightly saying that the ICC must investigate British ministers for complicity in the Gaza genocide. The UK is not only providing arms to Israel, we've discovered this, UK government had 28 extant and 28 pending high-risk licenses with Israel marked as most likely to be used by the IDF in offensive operations in Gaza. Remember, on October the 18th, Israeli forces bombed a residential compound in Gaza, housing the emergency medical team of Medical Aid for Palestinians, a British charity. Four British doctors were injured in that airstrike. alongside other medical aid for Palestinian staff members and a bodyguard. That particular attack was carried out by an F-16 jet, components for which have been supplied by UK companies. UK ministers enjoy crown immunity. They cannot be prosecuted for their individual actions, which is why we've never been able to bring a civil case against the likes of Tony Blair. And likewise, there's no chance of bringing cases in UK courts against the likes of Sunak and Cameron, but they cannot dodge the ICC much as they'd like to. I mean, to me, Patrick, we are in, I've said this before, but it's becoming even more acute. We are in a global constitutional crisis. You know, it seems that people like the Prime Minister Sunak, who was in Austria today, you know, dismissing with a wave of the hand the ICC preliminary request. It's worth remembering that these arrest warrants have not yet been issued. The prosecutor is applying to a panel of judges who will then decide whether or not there is sufficient merit in the case he presents to issue the arrest warrants. We're not there yet, but it is expected that they will be issued. But, you know, as I say, the likes of Sunak dismissing it, Biden obviously condemning even this action. And they don't have any evidence. They seem to think that politicians are above the law, that politicians can simply dismiss international courts. And if we end up going down that road, then we're basically going to be living in a gangster world, Patrick.
Well, many would argue that we're already there. But what do you think about, you know, the naysayers are saying this is, you know, meaningless. It's, you know, it's not even symbolic. Israel's not a signatory to the Rome Statute that recognized the ICC. Neither does the United States. And of course, neither does Russia or China, for that matter, or Iran. But Britain does. And all of Europe does. And does that mean, Basil, that the Netanyahu and Yoav the human animal Gallant will not be able to step foot in any of these countries that do recognize the ICC and would be compelled to act on an arrest warrant should any of these characters step foot within their jurisdiction? I mean, isn't that quite a major symbolic, you know, significant thing? Because it means that their travels now are restricted to really a handful of countries around the world.
Yeah, if indeed the arrest warrants are issued against Netanyahu and Gallant, and as I said, they haven't been yet, then first of all, under international law, the fact that Israel is not a signatory to the ICC is irrelevant. The Rome Statutes dictate that all countries where such offences are being committed and people are suitably accused can be arrested and tried. The ICC don't have the power to sort of invade Israel with international policemen, with Interpol or something, and start arresting people. But you're absolutely right. If the arrest warrants are issued and Gallant or Netanyahu set foot in any of the European countries or any other country anywhere in the world that is a signatory to the ICC, then those countries are duty-bound to arrest them. That's why Putin didn't go to South Africa recently, because South Africa is a signatory to the ICC, of course. So for all the wailing and gnashing of teeth from Netanyahu, and for that matter, all the naysayers who say this is symbolic or meaningless or something, on the contrary, this is extremely significant. Everybody said Karim Khan was sitting on his hands, that he was compromised, that he was very much the NATO-Israel choice for chief prosecutor. It's taken him months and months to even get to this point, but he was quite forthright when he spoke earlier this week about the reasons why and the charges against Netanyahu and Gallant. But Biden, of course, says there is no genocide. I mean, if there's no genocide in Gaza, I'd like to know what he thinks a genocide looks like. So, you know, where you've got a situation, well, we haven't had a situation like this before. This is the key thing, Patrick. We've never been in a situation where a country wholeheartedly supported by the European Union, by the United States, by the UK, has been accused in this way. It's always been somebody else, whether an African dictator or Slobodan Milosevic or Vladimir Putin. Very easy for the press and everything to demonize those people, to support the ICC, to say what dreadful people they are, butchers that must be arrested and all the rest of it. Now we're in a situation where, you know, this colonial project in the Middle East is in the hot seat, and it's a very, very different situation from any we've had before.
So what I think is extraordinary here, Basil, is the contrast now. You know, a big production was made over the indictments of Vladimir Putin and the other Russian official, claiming that they're guilty of the mass abduction of children from the Donbass or Ukraine. And if you look at the charges there, they're extremely weak. It's hard to find out what the actual crime is. It's all how it was framed. Moving children out of a war zone was then deemed to be kidnapping, according to the ICC. So there's a lot of challenges to that. Looking at these charges with regards to Israel, the evidence is pretty overwhelming, not to mention you've got the whole ICJ Genocide Convention case going on in the 80-something page document and so forth. I mean, there's no shortage of evidence to indict Israeli officials, military, and whatnot. So that contrast is there. But if the U.S. and some of these countries work to block this, then isn't there a danger, Basil, that this issue could actually destroy the International Criminal Court, its legitimacy, its reputation, if they cannot get any justice on what is one of the first examples, as you said, Basil? This is like a genocide in real time. This isn't going into the jungles of Rwanda trying to get witness statements a year after the fact. We've watched it live streamed on our phones. So this is a big challenge, isn't it, to the international system of whether they can actually make justice happen.
Oh, absolutely. The biggest challenge to international law in our lifetimes, Patrick, by quite a long way. You know, the United States likes to talk about the rules-based order. Well, it seems that it's a case of we make the rules and we order you to follow them. And it's quite obvious that the United States has been making up the rules as it goes along. There can be no question that it is failing 100% to apply universal standards. Israel is not judged by the standards of any other country anywhere in the world. And we have to ask ourselves why. If you've got an answer, then please let me know. Kenneth Roth says the demand for solid evidence is why Khan began with Israel's starvation strategy, because the evidence is readily available. Israel has barred his investigators, the ICC investigators from Gaza, where he would ordinarily want to investigate Israel's indiscriminate and disproportionate bombing. Khan has made clear that his investigation continues and more charges could come. An interesting a little vignette, Amal Clooney, of course, the human rights lawyer, wife of George Clooney, has apparently played a key role in the decision to seek this international arrest warrant for Prime Minister Netanyahu. The British human rights law was on a panel advising Karim Khan, the ICC prosecutor, but has previously, of course, been criticized on social media for not speaking out about the war crimes, talking about everything else. So perhaps that's why, perhaps she felt she needed to maintain judicial independence and avoid being accused of bias. Netanyahu, of course, there in that clip we heard, trotting out all the usual tropes about anti-Semitism, but it isn't washing with the world public anymore. They might still be buying it on Capitol Hill. I mean, both sides of the aisle seem to be united in their opprobrium at this. But the key point is this: they don't have any right to be. Politicians are not supposed to comment on legal matters. You know, legal matters are above effectively the pay grade of politicians. They should simply say, you know, the ICC must continue its investigation and we will abide by whatever findings they come to. saying, oh, just Israel isn't guilty of genocide and coming out with other stuff. I mean, it's like friends of a murderer, let's say somebody who's murdered his wife or something, you know, standing outside the courtroom saying, oh, we know that he didn't do it because he's our mate. You know, this is all a show trial. This is nonsense. I'm trying to intimidate the judges and the witnesses and the jury. You know, that is the equivalent that the current situation is. It's absolutely disgraceful.
And to pull the anti-Semitic card, not surprised he pulled it. It's almost like an obligatory addition to a caveat to any charge or accusation or criticism of Israel. But to say that these indictments somehow are anti-Semitic or that the International Criminal Court is an anti-Semitic institution, that's kind of like the direction they're going in. I mean, didn't they already do this with the United Nations? So, and again, they're sort of flogging that dead horse. And in a way, they're kind of hastening the redundancy of that charge right across the board. I mean, right now it's just, it's lost so much of its sting, hasn't it? This accusation of, quote, anti-Semitism. Is it one egg too many for that omelet, Basil?
Well, personally, I think it was some time ago. The way Netanyahu flings that term around when an increasing number of Jewish people, particularly in the United States, particularly young Jewish people, as we saw in the campus protests, as well as in the UK, want to wash their hands of the Israeli government. Ironically, it is Netanyahu himself who is being anti-Semitic, because he is tarring all Jewish people worldwide with the blood-stained brush of Zionism. Simple as that. That itself is anti-Semitic. Zionism and Judaism are not the same thing, and increasing numbers of Jewish people repudiate Zionism. Meanwhile, we have non-Jewish people, Gentiles, Biden, Sunak, Cameron, etc., who seem to be hurrying to embrace Netanyahu's bloody hand. So it's a nonsense. We've got to once and for all divorce the idea that just because Zionism is, as a political ideology, originated with Jewish people, that somehow it represents all Jewish people and criticisms of it are anti-Semitic. It's utter nonsense.
Yeah, good to point that out. Obviously, this is getting discussed a lot more, especially on social media. So it's good to see the conversation maturing on this issue. When before it was just verboten even to have a discussion about this, it was so loaded politically before. But now it's conversations opened up a little bit. I think that's overall generally healthy. I think everybody recognizes, Basil, that what we're seeing is a historic injustice, a crime against humanity on a scale that many of us have not witnessed before in our lifetimes in such a short space of time.
Well, I mean, it would be like saying that criticizing the perpetrators of the Rwanda genocide is anti-Black racism. Mm. Of course not.
Good point.
So it's going nowhere, that argument. And it's really very disappointing that anybody gives it any credence. You know, Netanyahu was talking about how the ICC, apparently, according to him, the fact that the ICC is seeking his arrest warrant fuels the flames of anti-Semitism worldwide. I would have said quite the opposite. Mm. If people can see that there is such a thing as international law and the perpetrators of genocide will be arrested for their crimes, that can only have a calming effect on relationships between communities. If, on the other hand, it's seen that one group of people, namely Israeli Zionists, are somehow above the law worldwide and can carry out genocide with impunity, that is much more likely to fuel anti-Semitism, Patrick.
Good point. Again, great point you make there, Basil. And you really just kind of cut through a lot of the static on this. Really appreciate your analysis, your levity that you're bringing to the conversation. That's why you are one of our absolutely most valued pundits on this program and right across the network. Appreciate you joining us here on TNT this week, Mr. Basil Valentine, political editor at TNT.
Thank you, Patrick.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to take a break right now with the network, though, and get ready for the final segment of the final hour of this live broadcast. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. You're listening and watching TNT, Today's News Talk. We'll be right back.
I didn't ask to be thrown in the streets with nowhere to go.
I
didn't think I'd survive. But I did ask for help, and Covenant House was there for me.
1 in 10 young adults will experience a form of homelessness this year. For these kids who didn't ask to be put in this unthinkable situation, Covenant House is there.
Covenant House helped me break the cycle of homelessness in my family. They gave me the love that I needed.
Over 2,000 young people will sleep safely in a Covenant House bed tonight. When youth who are experiencing homelessness have a hot meal, a safe place to sleep, medical care, and love, they can overcome heartbreaking challenges and have a brighter future.
They just really genuinely just wanted to help me succeed, and I'm succeeding. I'm a speaker, I'm an author. Covenant House really helped me and really helped mold me into the woman I am today.
If you or someone you love is asking for help, go to safeplacetosleep.org today.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's 1 in 5 daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. Again, we're in the final segment of the final hour here of this live broadcast on TNT, Today's News Talk. Thank you for joining us, whether you're listening on the audio streams, on the app, or online at tntradio.live. We really appreciate your listenership and your viewership here. Also on the live streams on X and YouTube as well. We're sharing that live stream on my Twitter feed at 21Wire, but just click through to TNT Radio there. Follow them on X for great updates and clips and a lot of breaking news as well. That's all happening. And during the break, I managed to twist the arm of our political editor. He had to go, but we've convinced him to stay because I know Basil's been looking at a couple of really important stories. We won't talk about the Iranian tragedy over the weekend, but there's other breaking news stories we'd like to get your comment on. Appreciate you staying for this overdrive segment, Basil.
Not at all, Patrick. I'm very glad to be able to stay with you. And just sort of pivoting away from the ICC situation, of course, there's also the big question of what happens next in Gaza when the annihilation finally stops. And Jack Lew, the US ambassador to Tel Aviv, has been talking about that. And bubbling away in the background is a big deal, the grand bargain, it's been called, which Biden is trying to foster, which involves normalization of Israeli-Saudi relations, but also some kind of new self-governance for the Palestinian people. Now, the Israelis want to have nothing to do with that because they don't want to have anything to do with anything that talks about a Palestinian state. So, you know, this push coming to shove, this, perhaps irresistible force, perhaps it'll be dissipated, meeting the immovable object of Israeli intransigence to a Palestinian state, something we've been talking about on this program as on the horizon, endlessly, year after year, month after month, and that October the 7th would finally see this come about more quickly. Well, Jack Lew's been talking about it and saying that there's going to have to be some period of quiet, I think, in Gaza, and there's going to have to be a conversation about how you deal with the question of the future of Palestinian governance. Blinken himself has said that he wants to see a concrete plan from the Netanyahu. My view, said Jack Lew, is that strategic benefit is worth taking the risk of getting into that conversation. He means about Palestinian governance. But that's a decision that the government of Israel will have to make and the people of Israel will have to make. He was speaking at a conference hosted by the Israel Democracy Institute, the IDI think tank. No irony in that title. But I mean, isn't it interesting that Lew is there talking about how
It's a decision for the government and people of Israel. What happens in Gaza? Isn't it for the, you know, self-determination, one of the key tenets of the international rules-based order? Isn't, you know, that what the United States is supposed to stand for? So why is it Israel that gets to decide what happens in Gaza?
And the West Bank too, and full stop. You know, this is an old story. They've been bandying about the two-state solution when most Israelis, Basil, and you know, they admit privately and now publicly, they have no intention of ever allowing an independent Palestinian state. And even then, what state would it be, Basil, realistically? A patchwork of small pieces of land woven together by this intricate system of Israeli security highways for military, no airport, no control over its utilities, its water, power, airspace, communications for that matter, and certainly its borders. So, I mean, the Palestinian state that Israel wants is the status quo. And look what happened with the status quo. Look at Gaza right now. Northern Gaza is basically a parking lot. That's Israel's contribution to a Palestinian state.
Absolutely. And of course, some of the more extreme factions in the Israeli government have talked about settling Gaza, about driving the remaining Palestinians out. I would imagine that what's on Netanyahu's drawing board is to take a chunk of Gaza in the name of security always. Mm-hmm. He's managed to herd the majority of the population into the south in the most inhumane and brutal way imaginable. And I think his plan would probably be for the Gazans to be reduced to a third of the previous territory in and around Rafah and very largely expelled from the rest. So just a sort of micro block, if you like, a few city blocks of Palestinian people on the edge of the border with Egypt. The United States yesterday described as near final a bilateral defense pact with Saudi Arabia. And once completed, the idea is that this will be part of a broad deal presented to Netanyahu to decide whether to make concessions to secure a normalization of ties with Riyadh. Those concessions, of course, have to be to the Palestinians because Riyadh is making noises along the lines that there's no full normalization with Israel unless there are concessions to the Palestinians, regardless of any bilateral defense pact with the United States. But as we know, a ceasefire is still elusive, and Netanyahu says it is premature to discuss what happens the day after. I mean, personally, I find the whole framing of this conversation absolutely obscene. The Palestinians are sort of not front and central in this debate. They seem to be regarded as an inconvenience. They're an inconvenience to the United States. They're an inconvenience to, obviously, Israel. And they're even an inconvenience to the Saudis, who, for some reason, have finally been moved to, you know, make some kind of milquetoast representation on their behalf, Patrick.
Yes. And the other thing that's going to get revived, unfortunately, that sort of turd in the punch bowl called the Abraham Accords. The Trump party, you know, campaign is making that sort of centerpiece of their pitch to voters for the 2024, Basil, basically saying that, you know, elect us and we brought peace to the Middle East with the Abraham Accords, and Biden brought war. Elect us and we'll bring the Arab countries and Saudi Arabia back into the fold. No mention of the Palestinians at all in the Abraham Accords. It's kind of like a runaround to any real negotiations. What are your thoughts on the Trump campaign still leaning on the Abraham Accords as a big sort of, you know, Kushner brokered success story?
Well, of course, you know, that bizarre map that Kushner produced for a sort of two-state solution. Well, I mean, looking back, it was better than what's happened since, wouldn't it? You know, I mean, Trump's main line is that none of this would have happened if he had remained prime minister, president, because he's sort of so much a better negotiator and all the rest of it. But he doesn't really offer anything different. He made, when Netanyahu visited Washington during the Trump presidency, Trump made an off-the-cuff remark about slowing up the settlements and was rebuked even for that, if you remember. So, you know, the Palestinian people don't hold out any hope for a Trump presidency, put it that way. It's going absolutely nowhere as far as they're concerned. The main thing with all this, really, the backstory is that I don't think the Israelis or the Americans, for that matter, realize the corner that they painted themselves into with this genocide with the rest of the world. I think the Israelis and Washington somehow think that, you know, this will all settle down and things will go back to normal and Israel is a valued member of the international community and so on and so forth. But Blinken was on Capitol Hill today, ostensibly to talk about the State Department budget for 2025. And he was hectored and heckled continuously by protesters. Blinken, you will be remembered as the butcher of Gaza, one protester shouted as Capitol Police officers threw him out of the hearing. You will be remembered for murdering innocent Palestinian civilians. Lots of other protesters were thrown out in just the same manner. Blinken apparently faced aggressive grilling by Democrats and Republicans alike for the administration's policies and actions towards Israel, specifically its support for Israel throughout the war. Now, I don't expect a huge amount of pushback from anyone on Capitol Hill, but the simple fact is that world opinion, as demonstrated by the ICC, is that Netanyahu, Gallant and their cohorts are all war criminals, you know, and that Israel, even Chuck Schumer said, is in danger of becoming a pariah state. This idea that somehow Jack Lew and Netanyahu and Herzog, who's talking about their historic struggles still, and it's not just against Hamas, Herzog says that Israel's engaged in a, you know, decades-long historic struggle. These people are living a completely different timeline from the rest of the world. You know, there's no going back to normality after this. People are not going to forget. I mean, apart from anything else, you've got tens of thousands of mutilated and severely traumatized children in Gaza. Who is going to look after them once this stops? Right? You know, it's just, you know, very, very arrogant, really, more than anything else, the attitude of the administration.
Yeah, they really, I don't know if they think they have any further to go to push this issue somehow back in their favor. It just seems to be getting worse and worse for Israel, this ICC, these indictments, if these are going to be handed down, the ICJ case, that's in the background, that could drop at any point over the next 8 months. So this is bad news, I think, for I think the U.S. establishment, both Trump and Biden. This is going to weigh heavily on both of them in terms of, it's not so much that there's going to be an advantage. I think probably Trump will get the advantage on this if Democratic voters sit out, Basil, on this just out of protest. Yeah. It's going to benefit Trump.
I think he will. Absolutely. I mean, I think he will. I mean, Biden has trashed his own base with his support for the genocide, and a lot of them won't come back. There's no doubt about it. Jill Stein is surging in the polls. She's up to 40% of young voters in some states, of 18 to 30. Now, they may well carry out their threat to vote for her. She could end up with 5 or even 8% of the vote nationally, which would be enough to completely destroy Biden, because although RFK supporters may, some of them may come from Trump as well as from Biden, Jill supporters are all going to be ex-Biden. So, you know, I can't see a way to the presidency again for Biden without some major cheating. Now, I want to do a pivot quickly to the Iranian helicopter crash story. Considering it killed the president and the foreign minister, really disappeared from the headlines remarkably quickly, didn't it, Patrick? You know, At one point, it looked like this was going to be a flashpoint, that, you know, perhaps the Iranians would be pointing the fingers at Israel, of course, very quickly, and see a further escalation. The timing, certainly, as close as it is to the exchange a few weeks ago, is suspicious, if nothing else. But the Iranians are actually pointing the finger elsewhere. They're blaming the sanctions imposed by the United States, the embargo on aviation parts, meaning that they haven't been able to maintain the safety of their aviation fleet. Former Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif argued that US sanctions are indirectly responsible for the tragedy by depriving Iran of the necessary spare parts and safety checks. Not many people have reported that in the corporate media.
Yeah, yeah, that's one of those issues. I mean, there's other people that are saying that's a good thing. They're saying, oh, look, sanctions are working. They've hurt the Iranians, and their helicopters are malfunctioning and killed their president. There's actually people making that argument, like celebrating the tragedy that's happened. I mean, it's, believe it or not. So they're saying, oh, this is why we need to keep sanctions going. So obviously some celebrations in Tel Aviv, you know, the likes of Piers Morgan and others are sort of, you know, kind of casting President Raisi as the butcher of Tehran and all these other things. I mean, isn't it amazing how you get these bizarre but kind of very disingenuous reactions from people in the West with anything to do with Iran, Russia, or whatever the axis of evil countries are at the moment. They just automatically demonize the leadership. And from what I understand, this is a very popular president who went out of his way to kind of be, you know, visiting people who are disadvantaged, less fortunate, lower income brackets, very much a man of the people, this president, very popular. And next in line is supreme leader. That's an important position in Iran. To be considered as the next supreme leader means that you have to be very well accepted by the broadest possible spectrum of people within the Iranian population. And it looks like Raisi fit the bill there. And so that's a tremendous loss for the country if you consider on the back end of Qasem Soleimani. And there's been so many other you know, leaders have been killed or have unfortunately fallen on very bad circumstances, air accidents, etc. I mean, putting conspiracy theories aside, the numbers on this are pretty shocking when it comes to Iranian leaders, people in distinguished positions that have been killed in some of these types of situations. So, I mean, yeah, we could say there is possibly some clandestine motive there to take out leadership in Iran, especially talking about Israel, for instance, the United States, yet to be proven. I don't think there's any evidence to that effect here, but people are, they're already getting ahead of that talking point. Actually, Politico issued a story, Basil, saying that this could somehow, if it's blamed on Israel, it could destabilize the region. Don't you think it's kind of strange that getting out ahead of that talking point, if there's no evidence to suggest that that's the case, unless they know something we don't? I don't know.
Well, there's also speculation that an internal power struggle within Iran may ultimately be responsible. Raisi has been seen as a potential successor to Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader. So with him out of the way, it now looks like Mojtaba Khamenei, the supreme leader's son, who is also a candidate for supreme leader when Ali Khamenei finally steps down or dies, he's now the front runner. So people are asking, you know, Abdul Arakian as well. He had made tremendous gains on the diplomatic front, the foreign minister who also died, Iran being admitted to the BRICS countries, and of course the normalization deal, the peace deal that the Chinese brokered with Saudi Arabia. These are really notable diplomatic successes for the Iranian leadership. Raisi and Abdul Arakian had been at the forefront of that. They're the ones that travel. whereas Ali Khamenei and his son tend to stay in Tehran. So I'm not making this up. This is Gabriel Noronha, a former advisor on Iran to the State Department. He's saying that the key takeaway is that, you know, that Ali Khamenei's son is now far and away the leading candidate to become the next supreme leader. So we don't know, you know, I don't want to accuse anybody of anything, but.
Yeah, you know, yeah, I want to sort of veer away from too much speculation there. The internal power struggle, conspiracy theory, probably the most remote of everything that's been tabled so far. However,
the space laser theory is the one doing on X that's the most outlandish. Directed energy weapons were used to bring down the helicopter. People are pointing to the fact that there were two other helicopters in the same flight that landed safely.
But it's my understanding those two helicopters were diverted to early in the flight path to another city, and they split. So that sort of, yeah, that explains that. So then that also raises the question, was why would the presidential helicopter be allowed to fly on its own in difficult conditions and terrain? That's a question. I think that's probably the key question in there. I just find the whole thing improbable.
Well, as you know, Patrick, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I do like to question official narratives. Immediately, three other aircraft crashes come to mind, the origins of which are highly dubious. Senator Paul Wellstone, of course, the only Democrat to vote against the Iraq war, who was verbally threatened by Dick Cheney, and his plane crashed just a week or two later. Ron Brown, of course, on the side of a hill in Yugoslavia in the Clinton administration, and John F. Kennedy Jr., who was apparently planning on running for president against George Bush II in the year 2000, when he met a watery end in the North Atlantic off Martha's Vineyard. So plane crashes are not always accidents.
That's right. Yep. John F. Kennedy Jr. could have been the next Democratic nominee. Who knows? So I don't know. I'd love to get the odds on a future engagement with you, Basil, to go and look at some of the presidential odds for some of these candidates. They got the VP races as well. You've got the Michelle Obama sort of thing rearing its head again. Roger Stone's prediction. So yeah, I know the odds on some of these on the political betting side. Would love to get your analysis on a future segment.
Well, it seems almost ridiculous now that people took that QAnon business seriously, that John F. Kennedy Jr. was somehow still alive and coming back. I mean, that's been a memory hole now, but goodness knows where that originated from. One last troubling headline before we go. Russia is beginning nuclear weapon drills near the Ukraine border, exercises in the use of tactical nuclear weapons are being interpreted as a warning to the West not to escalate tensions further. But it seems that's what London and Washington are determined to do, Patrick.
Tactical nuke drills, yeah, like for like. It's a response to NATO's escalation. The comments by Victoria Nuland, I mean, when is that woman going to retire and put us out of our misery? I mean, she is rearing her head, wanting to start another war with Russia. Hasn't she done enough already? And on top of that, she probably had too many cookies herself, Basil. But anyway, we'll have to follow up on some of these stories as we move ahead. Basil Valentine, the political editor here at TNT, Today's News Talk, really appreciate you laying out the world update for us this week. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patrick.
There he goes. That is Basil Valentine, a political editor at Today's News Talk. And also a big thank you to our other guest in the first hour, Taylor Hudak, a great independent journalist, giving us an update on Julian Assange's appeal. I hope we've covered everything today, folks. Great to have you all with us. Hello to everybody in the TNT chat community. We'll do it again tomorrow. Take care, you guys. Stay on the network, though. State of the Nation coming up on the other side of the top of the hour news headlines. Signing out, folks. Take care.